Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 14th of December. It's All Things Political. You always hear that on Mondays at 9 o'clock with a variety of guests. And today it's Professor David Michael Green, Associate Professor of Political Science at Hofstra University. We have a lot to talk about today. The president spoke about Afghanistan on 60 Minutes yesterday and other television shows, talking about needing more cooperation from Pakistan and not having enough of an Afghan military for the country to stabilize and how we will assist in that operation. Healthcare, he said that he thought that a healthcare bill will be out of the Senate before Christmas, which is next week. So we will look at that. Copenhagen going on. News today that developing countries have said that they're out of the talks now because the developed world is not doing enough to help. So they've fallen into a bit of disarray. What are your hopes for those talks? And whatever else you would like to, jobs, of course, is still very much something that people are concerned about, deeply concerned about and talking about. So those are some of the issues that we'll be discussing this hour and more with our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, which is up and running today, is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Professor David Michael Green, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it's always my pleasure. It's great to be back with you, Kathleen.
Yeah, nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with Copenhagen, because the news today is that China and India and another country, I believe, have said that's it. We need help from the developed world. The talks seem to be disintegrating. Do you have hopes that something will happen?
Yes and no. I mean, I gather the African states walked out this morning, but I think perhaps have already returned. So I think there's a, you know, kind of a lot of sturm und drang, kind of a lot of activity going on, but I don't know that I would describe it as definitive at this point. So the reason I say yes and no is my suspicion is that they'll come to some sort of agreement, but whether that will be an agreement that really seriously addresses the problem, that I think is far less likely.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of conflict there, actually sort of multidimensional conflict, all sorts of different pairings of different states or organizations who have different interests, and it's, I think, increasingly difficult to see how that those can be reconciled into some sort of meaningful treaty that will seriously address the problem.
Do you expect that the president will make an announcement when he arrives in Copenhagen that we will commit to this, and then he'll run into a big problem with the Senate in trying to get a commitment agreed to?
I think there's certainly going to be a problem with the Senate, almost regardless of what happens. Certainly if the president comes with a treaty, as we saw in the case of Kyoto, President Clinton signed that treaty but didn't even bother to present it to the Senate. So, yeah, that would certainly be an issue. I gather that the United States, along with China and India, is resisting the notion of any sort of legally binding commitments on greenhouse gas reductions. So it may not even come to the point where the president would have a problem with the Senate, because the administration may not sign on to any sort of document that would take the form of a treaty that would have to be ratified by the Senate.
There are some, as you well know, who believe that this is the most important issue for this planet. There are others who believe that, you know, the science is off. So I think the debate is pretty much over, that we have a significant problem here. Why is it so difficult for the world? I know it's hard for the world to reach agreement on something, but why is it so hard for us to move forward and address what so many are saying is a very, very serious problem?
You know, that's the question of the millennium, I would say. I think what you're looking at is kind of a classic tragedy of the commons scenario. You have so many people who have short-term interests that are in conflict with the mutual long-term interests of the society, in this case, the entire planet. So as I was alluding to earlier, you have certain states that have, you know, certain interests that run contrary to other states with a different set of interests depending on what your source of energy is, depending on what your level of development is, all these sorts of factors, depending on whether you're a small country on an island in the middle of the Pacific that will probably cease to exist in a period of several decades. And so the, you know, the structure of interests is promotes in some ways a lot of self-serving activity, and states, I think, state actors have a really hard time getting beyond that to recognize the long-term implications of what they're doing, and how utterly irrelevant all of their short-term interests will be if the long-term interest if the long-term scenario turns out to be disastrous for the entire planet. And I really think that's what we're looking at. And I think, you know, to the extent that there are humans around in a century and historians around in a century or two, I think they're going to look back at this as, you know, the utter height of foolishness, the most tragic meltdown of human intelligence, you know, ever in history. I mean, here we are with a situation. I mean, you know, it's hard to think of what a good analogy would be, but imagine that we had discovered a comet that was racing towards the planet. We knew it was going to hit the planet. We knew that there was a way that we could avert that, you know, say with some nuclear missiles or something. And then we sat and we squabbled about who would contribute most, whose rockets would be used, where we would launch, and what would be the impact on one group of people versus another group of people. And we sat there and we dithered, and then the planet got smacked by this comet, and that was the end. You know, that's where I think we are right now. And there's a whole other side story to this, which has to do with the credibility question. But I think, from what I can gather, I'm certainly not a climatologist, but from what I can gather in the community of climatologists, this is more or less a completely done question. Right. There are people out there who are trained climatologists who believe that, you know, who have some skepticism about this, and that's the way it should be. I mean, that's the way science should work. But by far and away, I believe that they're the minority in that community, and that amongst the vast majority, there's clarity about this issue, and therefore it becomes a public policy problem, and one that we're, I think, as a global community and also as a national community, really, really failing to step up to the plate and solve.
Right. It is, isn't it, though, a chance, as we're looking at a world economy that's not doing very well and looking for new jobs here in the United States, isn't this also a huge opportunity, a chance for economic growth in green energy?
Well, you know, that's exactly what I've been thinking for quite a while. I see this as a, you know, sort of a win-win-win possible solution for the Obama administration. So, first of all, there's what you just mentioned, which is this could potentially be a whole, you know, sort of industrial boom built around new forms of energy production. And you could imagine a kind of new Apollo program where you had a government and private industry partnership launching initiatives that would create, you know, tons of jobs and really perhaps be a driving force in revitalizing the American economy. And if you did it as well, and if you did it successfully, you would also go a long way towards solving this climate change problem. And if you did it as well, you would also go a long way towards solving a lot of our foreign policy issues, which are tied around oil in the Middle East. So, you know, at least in those three levels, which are three pretty crucial problems, you know, arguably the most crucial problems facing the country and the world right now, you've got win-win-win going if you would do that. But the Obama administration, as in so many other areas, I think has really kind of failed to grab the horns of this and take leadership on it and really put together a program, and then also to really, you know, market it to the American public and really pitch it and get the people lined up behind it. So it's as of this moment, it's really not happening, or at least it's not happening at a scale large enough to really produce those impacts.
It's happening, but Al Gore is still the guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. What about what the president said yesterday? I think it was on 60 Minutes last night, looking at health care. He was asked about whether or not we'd have a bill before Christmas, and he said that he thought that there would be a bill coming out of the Senate before Christmas, and he also said that he was very involved in this.
Well, both of those are a little bit shocking to me. I think the president has been incredibly deferential to Congress on this issue and so many other issues, and that really isn't the model of the, you know, post-FDR presidency. It's the model of the 19th century presidency. It's perhaps the model that the founders had in mind. I mean, I think I would say that it was, but we really have transcended that, I think, since the 1930s, and so for better or worse, and you can argue that this isn't necessarily a good thing, but nevertheless, the American public, I think, wants a strong leadership-style presidency today. And Obama, I think, has really been the antithesis of that. I mean, he's, you know, leave aside the politics, he's really at the opposite end of the spectrum from George W. Bush, who, or say Ronald Reagan, or FDR, or Lyndon Johnson, all of whom, you know, knew what they wanted, and they sort of stuffed it down the throats of Congress to some degree. And, you know, again, you can argue whether that's appropriate or not, but I do think that that is the contemporary model of the presidency, and that is, I think, to some degree, the expectation that the American public has, that they really want a presidency, a president who will lead and bring along the public and bring along Congress. And so on healthcare, I think, you know, this is an example in so many domains where Obama has, who knows what he's doing behind the scenes? I certainly don't. But I think what he's really clearly done is failed to exert the sort of public pressure that has been a successful strategic tool for so many presidents. Really, I think especially some of the ones that I mentioned, FDR.
Yes.
Excuse me. Reagan was excellent at this, and George W. Bush as well, and able to get what they wanted because of this. And I don't really see that kind of leadership there on his part. And as for turning out a bill before Christmas, I mean, I guess I would be fairly astonished. It seems to be going the other direction right now. I mean, it seems to be melting down with the Lieberman and the Ben Nelson defections. And we should also remember that there was supposed to be a bill, I think, originally during the summer. So we're long past that as well.
Right. Did you expect something quite different from Obama?
Oh, very different. The thing I didn't really know about Obama, and I think it was a fair question to ask, is where was he going to turn out ideologically? So, I mean, he was very careful, as a good politician is, unfortunately, I guess I would have to say, to speak in kind of generalities. And Obama, more than I think most politicians, resonated with different ideological tribes in America. So liberals could listen to him and say, oh, you know, that's our guy. And moderates could listen to him and say, oh, that's our guy, too. Listen to the exact same rhetoric. He was very skillful at that. But then when you have to govern, you have to make decisions. You can't be quite all over the map. So that, I think, was a pretty open question, and I was very unresolved as to whether, you know, the question that I would posit in my pieces that I write was, is this going to be FDR or is this going to be Bill Clinton? It turns out that he ideologically, I think, has been even to the right of Bill Clinton. I mean, I think in many ways it's remarkable how much he resembles George W. Bush in terms of his ideology. I know conservatives will fall off their chairs hearing that, but I really think it's true. What I did not expect, I mean, what I think is really astonishing about this president is, given the campaign that they ran, which was immaculate, and given his obvious rhetorical skills, I thought that this would be a hyper-competent presidency, and I thought also that they would be the masters of the kind of strategic communications, which is so key to having an effective presidency. And I think they've been really remarkable failures, actually, on both fronts. I'm very surprised about those two things.
It doesn't jive, does it? These extraordinary, and they are indeed extraordinary rhetorical skills. He's always, if you like him or you don't like him, a pleasure to listen to the way that he thinks about things. But to have that be so wonderful and not have a whole lot going on in terms of great leadership here, it's hard to put it all together, isn't it?
It's a real disconnect, but I want to give him some credit where it's due. And this is also something that I've been saying for a while, really since his Philadelphia speech on race. I mean, I think Obama has, you know, raised the political IQ of this country, mm-hmm. you know, 20 points, just because, you know, he's not a fully honest president in his rhetoric. So if you take, for example, his speech on Afghanistan, there were a lot of things that sort of weren't said that were really essential. But having said that, if you compare him to so many other politicians in, of the last, you know, generation or two, he's so much more honest. I mean, he's so much more three-dimensional in terms of the way he talks about the problems and the issues that face this country. And, I think that really, that could have a very positive long-term effect. I mean, if he can help us as a country to have a more thoughtful political discourse, that's a huge contribution. The big danger, and I think this is really becoming pretty evident now, no longer a danger, but perhaps a fact, is that, as you said, Kathleen, if the rhetoric and the action are so disconnected, then the rhetoric gets diminished as well, and people think, as I've started to find myself thinking, wow, nice words, but I don't believe what this guy says anymore. And so it actually, he could wind up with a net loss on both fronts that way.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We have a couple of people waiting, and I'm sure more in just a moment. Our guest this hour for All Things Political is Professor David Michael Green. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Hofstra University. We've talked about climate change. We've talked a little bit about his style and how our guest thought that he would be a different kind of president, that he has not been a very strong leader. It's interesting for us to talk about that as well. We'll look at more at healthcare, and also we'll talk about job development and whatever you'd like this December 14th. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. And the email address, if you'd like to use our email, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, 800-486-8655. Just wanted to let you know that the next hour of our program, a new report has found that the average American consumes about 34 gigabytes. That's a funny word, isn't it? A gigabyte of data and information each day. Most of that is through TV and computer games. We'll be talking about what types of information we are consuming and how with one of the researchers from the University of California, San Diego. Our guest this hour, Professor David Michael Green, Associate Professor of Political Science at Hofstra University. Our first caller is Michael from Rice Lake. Hi, Michael.
Hey, good morning. Hey, I just wanted to comment that the marketing or the discussion of climate change may be more effective if we change the focus from saving the planet, because I think the planet's going to take care of itself just fine, to saving ourselves, because that's really what's going to happen is the displacement of tens of millions of people, and even more personally, the displacement of the wealth of tens to hundreds of millions of people. As the climate changes, as the oceans rise and fall, and arid places change, our whole infrastructure is going to have to change, and that displacement is going to be insanely expensive. And so if we would change the discussion from saving the planet and saving the whales to saving ourselves, I'm thinking it might be better received and get a little more action.
Yeah, I think that's probably a good thought. I mean, this strikes me as actually a fairly easy idea to market. I mean, it's a catastrophic problem that's facing us. And I don't think the problem is so much marketing technique, although the caller, I think, raises a good point about how that might be altered in a more beneficial fashion. But I think the problem is a question of will. I mean, first of all, are you out there leading on this issue, and are you banging the drum so that the American public follows along? And then secondly, also, are you backing that with appropriate policies that so you're not just marketing something that's snake oil, that's some empty promise? You absolutely, in this case, have to do both. And it really goes to, I think, the question of, as I was alluding to earlier, the nature of the presidency. I mean, most presidents, it's interesting, I mean, we think of presidents as very powerful. We think of the presidency as a very powerful position, but you often hear from former presidents about their levels of frustration at how little power that they actually have. And the other thing you hear quite often from former presidents is that the greatest single power that they have is one that's not found anywhere in the Constitution. It's the power of the bully pulpit. That is you know, the power to be heard and the power to convince people. And this, as I was saying earlier, is really, to me, astonishing about the Obama administration. I don't really see, on any issue, frankly, I really don't see them out front even beginning to use the powers associated with the presidency. And it's remarkable, especially because he is so articulate. He is such a gifted communicator. So there's so much room for development here in terms of, you know, marketing this issue, and it's so crucial. There's certainly a lot of positive change that could be enacted on that front.
Is a bigger part of the problem, I was interested in what you said, that a lot of, he reminds you even of George W. Bush in some ways, is a large problem here that he doesn't have a strong ideology? Did you think he did before he became president, or is it indecipherable now?
No, I actually didn't think he was ideologically strong, and as I mentioned to you, he was fairly amorphous, and you know, people read into him. I mean, he even said this famously at one point. He said, I think he was actually a little disturbed by it, perhaps. He said, you know, I have this remarkable capacity that people project onto me, you know, their feelings and their politics. And I think that's very true of him. There were hints that he was fairly non-ideological in the sense that he, you know, talked about kind of moving beyond the ideological food fights that have characterized American politics for the last several decades. You can't really be non-ideological. You have to make decisions, and if you start stacking up those decisions, you wind up with something that could be potentially decisions all across the ideological spectrum, or they could be centrist, or they could be to the left or to the right. But I really didn't have very much in the way of expectations on that front. I didn't really know what he was going to turn out to be, although I will say I'm surprised that he's turned out to be as conservative as he has been. And again, that may shock a lot of listeners, but if you actually look at his policies across a whole range of areas, you know, if you look at the economic policies, if you look at the civil liberties policies with regard to, you know, detainees, and if you look at the foreign policy policies, the defense policies, if you look at civil rights policies with regard to gay Americans, on down the line, boom, 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 it's pretty shocking, actually, how much he maps up with the Bush administration, which obviously was a very conservative administration.
Thank you, Michael. Matt from Lake Geneva. Hi.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I read an article this weekend in Rolling Stone by Matt Taibbi called Obama's Big Sellout.
Right.
And the main thing about it for me was that he names names in there of progressive economists that were part of the campaign team who put out a message that that progressives could enjoy and think that, you know, things were really going to change. But then as soon as the campaign was over, Robert Rubin's team, and he names names right down the line, Robert Rubin's team moved right in from Citibank and all these people from Goldman Sachs. And the people, the progressive economists who were talking on the campaign trail, they're gone. They're gone to political Siberia,
right,
to places where they'll never be seen on television again, where they can be safely, you know, safely put away. And so I think that that this bodes really very badly for our economy, because now these institutions that Rubin is propping up, they're too big to fail times 10. And so a lot of investment in the financial sector is going to go to these institutions because they carry the imprimatur of being too big to fail. And that's what you call malinvestment. Investments will go from people who deserve them and places where they're needed in the economy to these giants, these financial giants that are basically sucking the life out of the economy.
Right. And this is absolutely in line with what I was saying about the way Obama's turned out ideologically. I mean, we have a giant economic crisis on our hands. It's a global crisis, certainly an American crisis. And if I would say to you that, you know, how do you think George W. Bush would respond to something like that? You might say, well, yeah, he'll take care of his buddies on Wall Street, and the rest of us will be left to fend for ourselves. If I had said to you a year ago, you know, how do you think Barack Obama would deal with it? I think you probably would have given a different answer. I would have. But in fact, it's turned out that Obama has pretty much played the same tune. He seems to have taken very good care of the folks on Wall Street and done really almost nothing for Americans who are really struggling. I mean, the American middle class and working class and poor have been really struggling for three decades now, or at least really kind of stuck in neutral at best. But now they're getting hammered. We're getting hammered. Once again, we have now a Democratic administration, an administration that's called by conservatives liberal, if not socialist, and yet they seem to be taking care of the same economic elites and really not paying very much attention at all to the wider public, which is really suffering right now.
And yet he is speaking out and certainly spoke out yesterday on bonuses that these Wall Street companies who have returned some of their TARP money and are doing just fine, thank you, right now, and paying people, you know, these incredibly huge bonuses. What
right.
in the world are they doing? He's speaking out about that.
Well, right. But again, I think we have the problem of rhetoric versus action. And the bonuses, Kathleen, I'm glad you raised this, they're incredibly huge, and I guess, you know, at one level we could ask the question, does it really make any sense for one person, for example, to earn in an hour what a salaried worker would earn in an entire year? But that's a philosophical question. But what makes them really obscene and really, something that transcends basic philosophical questions is these are bonuses being paid to people who ran their companies
right.
and the country and the global economy into the ground. So there's no sense of equity. There's no sense of, you know, pay according to performance. It's just, you know, if they do really great for themselves and their companies, then they get huge bonuses. And if they drive the company right over the cliff, they still get huge bonuses and at taxpayer expense. I mean, that's really, I think, obscene. And there's a lot of anger about that. Personally, I think there should be a lot more anger, but there's a lot of anger out there about that. And I think the Obama administration, I mean, the caller was really right. If you look at the people who are doing economic policy in the administration, they're all tied to Robert Rubin, and they're all tied to sort of Goldman Sachs and that Wall Street crowd, and the progressives have been marginalized, if not thrown out of the administration altogether.
What about jobs? They had that job summit last Thursday. Will there be a second stimulus? Will there be targeted money towards certain sectors who may be able to perform well?
Well, think about the job summit. Let me just start with that. I mean,
okay.
Isn't that sort of, I mean, I thought that was just pathetic, frankly. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to rant, but I don't want my president actually, you know, doing some sort of dog and pony show like that. I'd really like some sort of substantive policy being presented to the United States Congress that would actually do something about jobs. And I think the stimulus bill was a lot less serious about jobs than it should have been. And I think that now you have a situation where it's probably politically impossible to imagine another stimulus bill. I mean, who knows if the economy gets a lot worse, perhaps it's possible. But there's so much anger right now about national debt that people don't want to see any more spending by Congress, and that's probably that's clearly what it would require if you were going to have a second stimulus bill. And I mean, that's, I think, what we really need is some actual job stimulus, whether that happens to be green energy projects or infrastructure projects or education projects or state help to states and localities so that they can pay their bills and keep their employees on the payroll. That's the kind of thing that I think we actually need. It's basic kind of Keynesian economics to stimulate the economy. But because I think two things, because Obama, you know, misspent his political capital on a bad stimulus bill, and then secondly, because he just doesn't seem to be out there, you know, willing to fight the good fight and take leadership on these issues, I don't think there's the political will in the country right now for another stimulus bill.
Thanks, Matt, for your call. Al from Bayfield. Hi.
Yeah, good morning. I'd like to switch back to health care and raise a question, and you've got to build a huge number of hypotheticals into this, but I want to ask the guest if this is something that is politically possible. Let's assume that a health care bill passes, some kind of health care bill, and I don't care about the details. And everything we've heard says whatever passes, if it does pass, won't actually become implemented until maybe 2013 or 2014. Let's assume, second step, that in the midterm elections next year, the party in power is going to suffer some losses, and let's say they suffer some big-time losses. So the power, it's not a complete power shift, but they lose a lot of, the Democrats lose a lot. And then let's go one step further and say that in 2012, Obama becomes a one-term president. Republicans take over. Is it possible at that point for a Republican-controlled White House and Congress to negate the health care, whatever has been passed in health care?
I don't see why not, other than that some aspects of it might be implemented earlier than 2013 or 2014, I think particularly on the revenue side. Although this is a very fluid question now. I mean, we've seen just in the last several days some kind of wholesale changes to the bill that we've been talking about for, you know, several weeks at least in the Senate. Now they're talking about something almost entirely different with the extension of Medicare benefits down to age 55. So that's a whole other thing. So my proviso is I don't know what the plan will be, but assuming that you have a plan that begins its implementation in one fashion or another earlier, then obviously you can't do anything with what's already transpired. But I do think a new Congress and a new president could undo any legislation that is passed by the current Congress and signed by the current president. I'm not sure why that they would be inhibited from doing that in any fashion.
What do you think about that scenario that we could see huge losses for Democrats in the midterm and Obama would be a one-term president? Do you think that's a possibility, David?
I'll go further than that, Kathleen. I think at this point, I mean, obviously, you know, a year is an eternity in politics, but unless there's some major change, I would say it's almost a given. I mean, first of all, the party of the president almost always loses seats in Congress during the midterm elections, and, you know, there's only really rare exception to that. So if everything went swimmingly for Obama and the Democrats, we would expect them probably to lose a few seats in Congress in 2010. But things are not going swimmingly for the president or for the Democrats. And so my expectation is, particularly if you don't see a turnaround in jobs, my expectation is that the Democrats will get clobbered in 2010. And similarly, if something miraculous doesn't happen to the president in 2012, I think that he's also likely to lose his bid for re-election. The one caveat I would have there is it depends to some degree, but possibly not even to a large degree, on who the Republican candidate would be.
Right.
So, you know, it could be very interesting to contemplate what does it mean if you have Sarah Palin running against an incumbent president seeking re-election. But if you just think about it in ideological terms, you know, Obama, I think, on day one was lost to the conservatives. They were never going to support him, and they certainly haven't. They've really attacked him at every juncture, and even on stuff that's ridiculous. But so that's a constituency that was never going to be his. The moderates, I think, the independent voters in particular, I think did vote for him and were interested in his presidency and interested in supporting him. But their issue tends to be especially the spending question, and he's really lost them on that. They're really upset at the levels of debt and the levels of spending coming out of Washington, which I actually think are defensible if you would make the defense, and he really hasn't. So he's lost that cohort. And then liberals and progressives and all the kind of constituent groups in the Democratic Party are increasingly upset with him because his politics are fairly conservative and because he's not living up to their expectations. And so right at this very moment, you even have African Americans and gay Americans who are upset with President Obama. I mean, who would have imagined that, a year ago? And So if you put that all together, if you've lost the left and the right and the center, you know, you have to wonder who does Obama think would be voting for him in 2012. I think there's a real danger. It all will turn around the question of jobs. But I think there's a very real danger that he's a one-term president.
Interesting. But people don't like the Republicans either.
That's quite right. You know, and again, so part of this calculus turns on who the Republicans would nominate in 2012. But I think what in 2010, what you're going to see, and to a very large extent in 2012, is you're going to see a referendum on the incumbent party. And in America, if you don't like the incumbent party, you only really have one other choice. You know, and I mean, I hesitate to say that because that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. But realistically, that's the mentality of most voters. And so if you don't like the Democrats, then you have to vote for the other choice, and you have to sort of suspend the fact that 2 years ago you really didn't like the Republicans and you were voting against them for the very same reason. Mm-hmm. But you know, functionally, that's basically how democracy works. I mean, you basically, you know, the party in power is responsible, and voters will essentially be voting on whether they're happy with the performance of that party. And what other choices you have will depend on what political system you're talking about. But in this system, it's one other choice. And so I think you'll see I suspect you'll see a very big migration to the Republicans in 2010. A lot of people will be holding their nose as they cast that ballot, but they'll cast that ballot nevertheless.
Thanks, Al, for the call. Ray from Milwaukee. Hi.
By the way, we have a third choice. We can write in candidates, and we can also push for a third party. I voted for Obama, and I really lobbied my friends to vote for him, and I am just disgusted. And the other day I heard Jesse Jackson speaking on how Mr. Obama has done bailouts for his friends in Wall Street and, you know, the insurance agencies, big car companies, they get money. But even Jesse Jackson said, where is the bailout for people on the south side of Chicago, in the inner city of Milwaukee, in the inner city of Washington, D.C.? If you want to see a ghetto, you want to go to Washington, D.C. and see the inner city there. It'll blow your mind. I'm ready for impeachment. This guy,
oh my gosh,
told us. He sold us a bill of goods, and just for his actions in the banking thing, where he put Timothy Geithner as head of our IRS, and Mr. Geithner owed $36,000 from 4 or 5 years ago, and he said it was an honest mistake. And then they continued putting former Clinton people into the same slots. These were the people that crashed this plane, and they want to give them the ability to pilot the plane again. Have we lost our minds in this country is my question, and let's start impeachment now.
Thank you for, I think, verifying what I was saying. I mean, I gather the caller would describe himself as a progressive, and he's really angry that the candidate that he thought might be a progressive has turned out to be anything but, and that's certainly my take on the situation. That's certainly also my personal set of feelings about Obama, huge levels of disappointment. And I think that, you know, amongst the progressive community, that's really the critique of Barack Obama. I think there's a very different critique from the moderates and a very different critique from the right, but everybody is critical right now for very various reasons. I don't think that he's making very many American voters happy right now, and so I don't think impeachment is in the cards, although there's certainly a lot of people who are angry enough that they would want that, but, you know, I don't think that's realistically, politically speaking, in the cards right now. But the possibility of the Democrats getting clobbered in 2010 and then Obama losing his bid for re-election in 2012, I think, is very high.
Professor David Michael Green is our guest for All Things Political today, Associate Professor of Political Science at Hofstra University. Our phone number, thank you for your call, Ray, is 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Monday, we'll be talking about a UC San Diego study that looks at how much information Americans consume and where we get the bulk of our information. It's a very interesting study. So that's coming up. We'll talk with one of the researchers following the news from National Public Radio. This hour, Professor David Michael Green, Associate Professor of Political Science at Hofstra University. We go to Scott from Green Bay. Hi.
Good morning. I guess my point has to do with the president, and I guess I'm somewhat surprised by the reaction. I'm going to go back to the first Bush election when everybody talked about Bush needing some gravitas. That was the famous word that was out there in the press all the time. And conservatives have been saying this since the campaign, that President Obama lacks gravitas. I mean, he was the guy, he was the Rorschach test. You looked at him and you saw whatever you wanted to see in him. I mean, he's very good at reading a teleprompter, but that's really about it. I mean, we're almost a year into his presidency, and there's really not a major accomplishment that you can hang your hat on for him. I mean, the stimulus package was the big thing, and by all accounts, that is somewhat of a failure. But other than that, I mean, I know he's talked about a lot of things. Most of the positions, like your guest said, are just Bush carryovers on critical issues. But conservatives have been saying that for a few years, that we invented President Obama. There was a great article by a woman who compared Tiger Woods and President Obama, where there's a myth about the individual. We created this myth of who Tiger Woods was, and he really wasn't that. And in the press, they created this myth of Obama during the campaign, and it's just a myth.
Professor Green.
Well, I want to start with a caveat, which is this. I think conservatives in America, I don't think there's anything Obama could do that would please them, and I think that they get angry with him for there was just an article by George F. Will, to give you an example, of talking about how Obama's moving way too fast on way too many fronts, and I thought as I read that, well, wait a second, wasn't the critique just last week that he was dithering, that he was taking too long to decide his Afghan policy, and et cetera? So, I mean, if you look at the content of, I would say, most conservative critiques of Obama, you really get a sense, I certainly do, that they are determined to be critical. They are determined to be obstructionists. Having said that, though, I absolutely agree with the caller that, and, you know, I think perhaps for very different reasons than perhaps conservatives would, but I absolutely agree with the caller that Obama is now coming close to having been in office for a year, and he's got very little to show for that, and particularly at a time of great crisis, multiple crises in American society, which are fairly screaming out for solutions, and particularly at a time when he got, I think, something fairly close to what you could describe as a mandate for action. It's fairly astonishing that a year later that we really have very little to show for that.
What about in the world arena? He did receive the Nobel Peace Prize last week. He attracts tens of thousands of people wherever he speaks. He is adored in Europe. He is revered in Asia and in Africa. He has the ears and the attention of people in the world in a way that certainly the previous president did not.
Well, that's absolutely true. And part of the equation, of course, is that he's not the previous president. So I think simply by being not George W. Bush, he has, you know, changed America's stock in the rest of the world dramatically, and dramatically for the better. But the rest of it also, I think, is really kind of being Barack Obama rather than doing foreign policy. So, I mean, I think a lot of that very positive global public perception of him has to do with who he is as a person in terms of his ethnic characteristics, in terms of his global, you know, sort of personal background, in terms of his rhetorical skills. But if you look at his policies and if you look at what he's actually doing, I think there's a real disconnect there once again, and there's a lot of disappointment. And maybe the case of the Middle East, the Israeli-Palestinian question is paradigmatic here. So Obama gives a speech in Cairo, and he seems to be kind of leaning on the Israelis to stop building the settlements, and then essentially Benjamin Netanyahu thumbs his nose at the president and nothing happens. And so you have a president then effectively who gives a speech and uses words in a way that really command our attention, but nothing changes in terms of policy. Nothing changes in terms of developments on the ground. And so ultimately, I think that that disconnect will catch up to him internationally, as it seems to be doing domestically now.
Thanks, Scott, for your call. Let us go to Fred from Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Fred.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
Oh, just a few comments. I get a little amused only 11 months into his presidency. I'd much rather wait, you know, until we're further into it. But on the comments, I'm sure a lot of Democrats are probably wondering what it would have been like if Hillary would have won instead of Obama. The other thing is, with the Republicans not compromising on anything, I don't really see what he could have gotten through. The one thing he could have done, and he would have got lambasted by the Republicans, I'm sure, for being weak, would have been to pull out of Afghanistan. This he could have done. He didn't have to worry about the Republicans voting for it or not. He had that in his power to do it, and I think in the long run, with he would not be having the Republicans like him, but I think the public sure would have been enamored on that. But he didn't do that. He fell into that trap of the 30,000 troop surge. The other thing that I always wonder about is I don't see any of the organizations like MoveOn.org or et cetera supporting him with TV commercials. Every night, several times a night, I see a commercial on TV by the Chamber of Commerce on call your legislators. We do not need a health care bill. We can't afford it. And I keep thinking, where are the advertisements countering this from the Democratic side? So that's just a few of my comments.
Thank you, Fred.
Thanks. Let me start, see if I can remember all your thoughts. I think you began by saying that it's too soon to judge him. You know, people have been saying that for about a half a year now, at which point that may have been the case. Now I think it's really not. I mean, first of all, we should remember that if Obama's really going to pass any major legislation, it's pretty much going to have to be in his first year or so, because as you get into the second year, then you have the looming midterm elections, which changes the calculus on everything, and then you have the elections themselves and a new Congress, which is very much likely to be less Democratic and less supportive of him. And then, of course, you've got, you know, the problems of governing under that scenario. I think if you look at the intentions, I mean, look at the content of the health care bill. Look at what it is. Look at what it isn't. Look at the recovery package. Look at the people that he surrounded himself with. I guess I would say that it's not too soon to make these determinations, and I guess I would say that it's not too early for people to be disappointed with the content of his first year of his presidency. As to Hillary, I tend to doubt that her administration would be very much different than what we've seen from the Obama administration, which strikes me as kind of Clinton redux, and he's certainly surrounded with many of the same people, and I would imagine that she would have done the same. And finally, I think the caller makes a really good point about the Republican opposition, but I would ask people to make this contrast. I mean, think about George W. Bush selling the war in Iraq. That was a policy that people in America didn't want. And yet they put the hammer down, and they did a full-court press, and that was in your face 24/7. And ultimately, they actually brought public opinion around. Now think about health care, which is, you know, an area where people really do want change, and they really do want some help. And think about the absence of that full-court press. And the caller alluded to this as well. I mean, there's just not this coordinated strategy to really move public opinion, starting at the top and filtering all the way down through all the MoveOns and other organizations. And it's just not happening because you don't see this, you know, strategic communication skill, and you don't presidency leadership, and I don't think you see the willingness on the Obama administration to fight and the willingness to make enemies. And I think it really costs them, and it's really I think hurting their legislative agenda and hurting his presidency.
So you think it would be quite different if he, and he has said what he wanted. What he will take is a different story. But if he had come out strong early on in this health care debate and said, I really want a public option, or I want Medicare for all, or this is what this administration wants, we would be at a different point right now?
Absolutely. I think it's been unclear, and it remains unclear just to this day, exactly what the president wants from this. And I think that's a fatal mistake. I think the president needed to lay out, you know, one or two or three very clear, very simple points and just hammer those over and over again. And I think that was a huge mistake. And then during the summer, I mean, he completely lost control of this issue, and you mm-hmm. have these, you know, tea parties and people making up outrageous lies about the legislation, and I think that really hurt badly as well. I mean, there's a real palpable sense of lack of conviction in this administration, which is absolutely contrary to what you saw, you know, for example, in the George W. Bush administration. I mean, I thought the politics of the Bush administration were disastrous, but they were extremely effective at getting what they want. And if that's the measure of a presidency, and it probably should be the measure of the success of a presidency, to what extent does the president get what he or she wants, you'd have to rate the Bush administration, I think, far above the Obama administration in that sense.
Professor Green, thank you so much for being with us again. It was a great hour.
Oh, it's always my pleasure. Let's do it again.
All right, we will. Professor David Michael Green, Associate Professor of Political Science at Hofstra University. If the callers and our guest are any indication, the president has some work to do. We will continue our conversation for this Monday in just a moment. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production. News coming up, and we'll return with more talk on the Ideas Network.